It's season 2, episode 16 of the Doctors and Litigation podcast. I'm Gita Pensa. Welcome back. Okay, everybody, this month we've got a follow-up from last month's episode called When the Government Comes Knocking, that interview with Tony Box. You should definitely listen to that before you listen to this episode. But as I say every once in a while, really, if you're new to this podcast, the place that you want to be is season one. I'd say start with season one introduction, work your way through that, and then in season two, jump around wherever you want. Except for this particular episode where you really should listen to episode 15 first. Because then you will understand what a rarity the interview that I have to offer you today is. So let's get right to it. As promised, I have an interview with Dr. Muhammad Ali Rafai, a psychiatrist who was accused of wrongdoing by the Department of Justice and fought it all the way. So here he is to tell his story, and I want to thank him for being willing to talk about such a difficult time in his life in an effort to give hope to other physicians who may be facing similar circumstances. Dr. Muhammad Ali Rafai, it's so great to have you on the podcast talking about your legal victory and other things.
Thank you very much for having me. I look forward to sharing with my colleagues my story about my involvement with the Department of Justice.
So the listeners will have heard Anthony Box's segment on dealing with the government when the government comes knocking, as they say. But I thought it would be really instructive to have you come and talk about your experience in litigation with the government, especially with the perspective of somebody, I'll just cut to the chase, that you won and really sort of fought your way through this case. And I thought, you know, we hear so many doom and gloom stories about this. We see a lot of headlines where the Department of Justice is the one winning out, or whichever government agency is bringing the prosecution is the winner. And we don't really hear as often about doctors who choose to fight for really their name, I guess, is to fight the government charges. And so I think this will be a great conversation for people to hear. So tell us a little bit about what you do. You're a psychiatrist. Talk to us about your practice.
I'm a psychiatrist and an internist, and I've been in practice for 25 years. I did my residency at University of Virginia. I'm trained in board certified in internal medicine and psychiatry. I then worked at the National Institute of Mental Health. I did a lot of research and a lot of pioneering work in psychiatric research, and moved to Pennsylvania, to the greater Lehigh Valley area, about 20 years ago and started a private practice. I've always been involved in telehealth and telepsychiatry. So I did telehealth before it was sexy, before COVID, before 2020, and started doing telehealth in 2006. And this is probably why I came to the attention of the Department of Justice and the Department of Health and Human Services, the Office of Inspector General. We did telehealth work for rural areas in Pennsylvania, and the Department of Justice and the Inspector General for Health and Human Services thought that my billing pattern was different than my colleagues. Well, sure, I was the only doctor that was doing telehealth in Pennsylvania between 2010 and 2020. And the government thought that our billing was incorrect, even though I was on the cutting edge. I was on top of how we did our billing. And subsequently, after an investigation that lasted for about 7 years, from 2015 through 2022, the Department of Justice decided to indict me in 2022 based on healthcare fraud charges, arguing that our billing for telehealth services was not appropriate.
So let me ask a question. How did it start? Did you get a notice that they were investigating you?
We got a notice in 2017 that they were doing an audit, and we responded to the audit. I actually hired an attorney in 2017 and an expert coder, and they reassured me that all of my work was appropriate. But despite that, and despite us responding to the audit, the snowball continued. And in 2019, the government came with a search warrant for my office. And they wanted records on the patients that we saw between 2015 through 2019. We provided all the records and we provided everything. And then they went away and never came back until beginning of 2022, where they said, well, listen, Dr. Rafai, we think what you did was criminal and you're a criminal target and we are going to indict you.
So even though you supplied all of the records, your healthcare attorney was able to look at it and say everything is appropriate. They came and took the records with the search warrant. They still decided, even though you had all this evidence to support you, they still decided to indict you. Tell us about that process. What was that like for you? Did you get a letter? Did they come in person? How did you find out that you were getting indicted?
I did get a letter and they came in person. So the agents came to my office and said, Dr. Rafai, here is a target letter. You are a target of a criminal investigation. And when I consulted with an attorney, he said, well, you know, they send you a target letter. That means that they are intending to indict you. And despite the fact of my criminal defense attorney that I involved and the fact that I provided all this evidence, it's more like a train. It's a train going from station A to station B to final destination, which is station C, which they hope is to convict a physician and put them in jail. That's the train trajectory.
They weren't asking for a settlement, some monetary settlement.
My attorney says, well, why isn't this being handled as a civil settlement if there is a dispute about billing? And they're saying, well, we are convinced what he did is criminal and we can prove that in court.
Did you have a good understanding of the charges against you?
I did not have a good understanding of the charges. They never explained to us anything. And it wasn't until the indictment came and they started providing us with the evidence that they had that we understood what is it that they were talking about. And we found out that they had everything wrong from A to Z.
And was there any opportunity to explain to them, like, look, this is what you've got wrong here. Like, let us demonstrate to you.
My attorney's position was, you tell them what is wrong. They will change. They will retool the case and come at it as a different way. Your only chance is to go to trial. Go to trial and prove your innocence in front of a jury. And that's what we did.
That is so interesting too. So you had a healthcare law attorney. This was the same as your criminal defense attorney, or did you have a separate attorney?
No. I had a different criminal defense attorney. I had to hire somebody who only does court work. The person that I hired initially for the audit was somebody whose main expertise is medical record audits and administrative issues with Medicare. Now, with a criminal trial, I had to hire a criminal defense attorney. And I was very lucky because the criminal defense attorney that I hired had a very good understanding of the field of psychiatry. His father was a psychiatrist, his brother was a psychiatrist. So he understood the field of psychiatry from A to Z. And that was very, very interesting that he was able to provide us with a very good understanding and was able to provide the jury with very good understanding about what is it about being a psychiatrist and providing services.
Can you tell us what the accusations were?
Sure, absolutely, yes. I was charged with four charges of healthcare fraud. And the services are four services. They picked four services at random. And these are clinical encounters. These are patients that were seen. They didn't say anything. That we didn't say, oh, you billed on a patient that you didn't see. Or they said, you saw these patients. What you billed is inappropriate. We think you billed extra. In psychiatry, we bill something called add-on services, so psychotherapy. So in addition to just meeting the patient and adjusting their medications, you do talk therapy. The government says, well, no, you just met with the patient, you adjusted their medication, and you didn't do talk therapy. Their whole understanding of how that coding system is was wrong, was completely wrong. They were using the CPT coding system from 2012, while actually in 2013, the coding system changed completely, and we were using the right coding system. So in my trial, I only presented two witnesses. I presented a psychiatrist and I presented a coding expert that completely dismantled the government's case.
Wow. Now, you're paying for all of this defense out of pocket. Did you have any insurance at all?
Myself, my family, my wife is a physician. I have three siblings who are physicians. They all believed in me. It cost us like $1 million to defend this frivolous lawsuit. And we talked about this audit that they did in 2017, where I hired a defense attorney. And at trial, and because of my expert witness, we showed that actually the auditing contractor almost fabricated the entire audit results. The government were going on the fact that their auditing contractor told them, Dr. Rafai's work is all fraud. Everything they did is wrong from A to Z. They received a report that my work was 100% false. Everything was wrong. And then when we confronted the expert that the government hired from this auditing contractor, we confronted her on the stand. And she actually retracted completely. She said, I do not support this audit. I do not support the government's case. It was an epiphany in the court. They call it a Perry Mason moment, where like the government's own witness backtracks and disavows the government case and says, I'm the government's expert, but I don't support whatever they did. I'm out of this case. And the jury heard that. And this was, I would say, probably 70-80% of the fact that the jury decided to come up with a not guilty verdict, because the expert that the government, they had only one expert, the expert that they brought on the stand, she just said, I do not support the government's case nor their investigation. Everything that they did was not right.
Okay, so they came back with a not guilty verdict.
It took them about 3 hours. It took him about 3 hours, the most difficult 3 hours of my life.
I don't know what it feels like to do that in a criminal trial.
It's your life on the balance. The government in the press release said, oh, he could be jailed for 40 years related to these four charges. And remember, each charge, basically the difference is we billed for these services $75. The add-on was an additional $43. So four services of $43.46 each, less than $180.
Only four services?
Four services. Those are the charges, but they're representative of like our entire billing. So they got four charges that are the crimes.
Yeah.
And they're representative of other billing that we did. And okay, when they computed that, they came up with $1.3 million that they wanted back from me.
So they wanted $1.3 million back from you, plus you to go to jail for 40 years.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Well, no wonder you fought tooth and nail. Now, there's no opportunity for you to get that money back from the government that you spend on your legal case.
I'm happy that you're asking about that, because about a month ago, we have filed a motion with the judge under a federal law called the Hyde Amendment to actually recoup our attorney's fees and expenses. And the motion is in front of the judge right now. And the government has to explain in details what they did with this case and why did it take this disastrous nosedive where the case actually went into the valley of innocence for the defendant.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so you'll hear about that sometime soon?
So March 24th, the judge just ordered the government to make an explanation of what happened in this case. And we're going to see what the government is going to say. And maybe they're going to say, oh, we believed our expert. Our expert led us astray. But we'll have to see how they're going to answer what happened in this case. And on top of it is that basically it gutted their entire case, because basically there was no basis for them to do a search warrant in 2019. When we said that this audit was completely fabricated and false, there was no basis for them to get a search warrant in 2019. So their entire case kind of fell apart. We'll see what happens.
Oh my goodness. I have all my fingers and toes crossed for you. I hope you get to recoup those things.
It's still a legal saga, even though my trial was in May 2024. I was found not guilty. It is continuing. There's like a part two of the story of kind of fighting with the government now to get that money back of whatever I spent on the trial. And they're going to fight tooth and nail. And probably this will go to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. And it may end up on the United States Supreme Court. So stay tuned.
We will definitely stay tuned. I have a question for you. I mean, a lot of the podcast episodes are about the real psychological difficulty of enduring civil litigation. And I make the point often that civil litigation is about money. And usually the money is not coming out of the defendant's pocket. Even if there is an award, the defense, any of that stuff, none of that is coming out of the defendant's pocket. How did you contend with the stress of not only being falsely accused, but to have to find the money to mount for your defense and contend with this possibility of going through this legal system, which, as we know, can be rather capricious, and this possibility of going to jail?
It was a possibility. You talked with your lawyer guest about the statistics, but the Sentencing Commission statistics from 2022 is that less than 1% of federal criminal defendants are exonerated. To be specific, 0.4%. So 4 out of 1,000 will be found not guilty. Everybody else will be guilty and will go to jail.
That's daunting.
That's very daunting. And you have to prepare yourself. So I'm a psychiatrist and I have good family support, but I prepared myself that I was going to go to jail. I even took the initiative and went to the jail that I would probably have chosen to go to in New York. It's in Otisville, New York. It's a federal penitentiary. And I prepared myself that that's the jail that I'm going to go to.
Wait, this is fascinating to me. You went and visited the jail?
I went and visited the jail from outside. It's like, okay. You know, you're going to trial. I need to know where I'm going. If I'm going to go to trial, if there's a possibility of jail, and I went and visited the jail and I said, I'm at peace. It wasn't going to be 40 years, but the government kind of amplifies the numbers. It's like, okay, I'm going to spend a big chunk of time in that area. I better go and prepare myself psychologically because I may end up there. So I went, I drove on a Sunday and spent 2-3 hours just looking at the It's an open camp, so it's not like jail with high walls, and white-collar defendants usually are in camps, which is an open. I mean, it's open. You can walk out if you want, but they'll come after you. But you're in a small building. There's a cafeteria. There's a walking track. There's some sports, things to do, but that's it.
It's still jail.
It's still jail, yes. And you'd be there for years with how much the government had it for me. And, you know, when somebody takes them to trial, they get upset. That means that you're saying what they are saying about you is wrong, is not right, and that you're fighting. And so they go for higher sentence than if you had said, well, okay, I agree, I'm guilty. But I knew I was not guilty. I did everything right. I had coding experts. I did everything by the book. And the government just didn't have it. And they had everything wrong from A to Z.
Now, you and I were talking before the podcast about your experience in civil courts before this episode happened. And you worked extensively as an expert and had some familiarity with the law. Do you think that helped you have the fortitude to go through this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It helped me a lot because it helped me not fall into the pitfalls that other criminal defendants have.
Tell me more about that.
So one of the main things, for example, is that when the government came with their investigation and with their search warrant, my position was to not talk to the government. Nothing. So invoke your Fifth Amendment rights, invoke your right to an attorney, and never talk to the police, never talk to the government, never ever, because it never helps. Because we physicians have the attitude of like, oh, if I can try to explain my position, exactly what you said. If you can sit down with the government and tell them where they went wrong and
how naive.
Their objective, their position is to convict you, is to put you in jail. That is the target. Not to say they're conscientious, they're hardworking, they're public servants, but their goal is to put you in jail. That's it. It's a train going from A to J, which is jail for you. Basically, that's the destination for them. And basically, whatever you tell them, it's going to be twisted into this narrative that they have that you are a criminal, you did healthcare fraud, you defrauded the government, you stole from Medicare. This was my press release. Dr. Rafai stole from Medicare. Having court experience really helped me. Number one, I never talked to the government. I did not testify in my trial because there was nothing to testify about. I never talked with the government. I never said anything. It's all the medical record will be the judge of what I did and what we billed, and my experts will explain. And we hired a psychiatrist, a practicing psychiatrist from Georgia. And he came and he said, I don't know what this government is talking about. This is bread and butter psychiatry. They didn't do anything out of the usual. And my lawyer said, this guy has like a regular house. There's no Ferraris. There's no boats. There's no planes. There's nothing. They barely make it. They barely survive financially. So what is the government saying that they're committing fraud? And the government had no answer. I mean, they never even talked about the financial aspect of things. They just said, oh, these were billed incorrectly. That's healthcare fraud. You go to jail.
Well, I applaud you for the fortitude it must have taken for you to endure this, first of all, and to have the presence of mind to do everything that you needed to do to contribute to your defense. It sounds like you were thinking very strategically and helping your attorney every step of the way, even though the stakes for you were very high. You never fell into a state of panic. I really admire the going, looking at the jail and trying to come to a place of acceptance about it. It really blows my mind, but I'm so impressed. But I wonder if you have any parting words for physicians who might find themselves in a similar situation where they have either just made a, you know, a well-meaning mistake or really confidently feel that they did nothing wrong when they are faced with this kind of an accusation. What would you tell them?
Number one is never talk to the police. Never talk to the investigators. Stay silent. Never try to explain your position. Basically, it never helps. Never, never, ever. So never talk to them. Number two, you really need to seek the representation and the advice of an attorney who specializes in these things. This is a very specialized field. Healthcare fraud, white collar crime is a very specialized field. And unless your attorney really have deep knowledge of the healthcare system and medical billing, you will not be successful in a defense. So you're better off by pleading if you don't have the right attorney. Hire experts that will dispute the government's case. If you believe that you did everything right, hire good experts that will explain your position and that will explain how is it that you were compliant with Medicare rules and regulations or private insurance rules and regulations. These things are very ambiguous. These things are very opaque. They're very complex. And sometimes it's very difficult to explain them to the juries. So having good experts that could simplify things and explain to the juries complex medical topics, I think is very, very helpful and can go a long way actually exonerating physicians. We physicians are very well-meaning. Some cases where the physician did something completely wrong, and that usually can be demonstrated very easily. But in my case, it was my expert, my attorney actually believed in me, but he says, you know, 99% you're going to get convicted. It wasn't until my expert witness came to the attorney and said, there's really no case. They have no case. Everything is wrong. They fabricated the whole thing.
My goodness. Well, I'll be waiting on tenterhooks to find out what the judge says. I really hope that you are able to recoup some of these costs. I think that will be truly inspirational for physicians who are, you know, feeling a lot like sitting ducks when they hear this story. But I really want it not to scare them. And this is the same as the initial piece on, you know, when the government does come knocking. I think it's important to know that it's a possibility that this is considered a revenue stream for the government. But then when they really are coming looking for criminal time as a deterrent, which is the only, I mean, that's all I can think of that they think it possibly could be. And you're caught in the crosshairs and you're innocent. I think even if you are the slim, slim minority, I think bringing you on as a reason to hope and to fight, I think that that's really valuable.
They do this to 500 physicians every year. I don't know if you know that, the statistics. There's 500 physicians that are prosecuted every year. And it's usually a combination. They always combine healthcare fraud and controlled substances. And they try to have that trifecta of healthcare fraud and controlled substances. And even though if it's majority healthcare fraud, they try to find some prescription, some controlled substances prescription that you did wrong, and they make it the crime of the century just to sink your case so you wouldn't have a defense. So 500 physicians every year, 3 or 4 per U.S. Attorney's Office. They have a quota of 500 physicians every year that they should prosecute and put in jail.
Well, know your rights. First of all, you know, whatever you can do to stay out of the situation, doesn't sound like you could have done much in this case, but you are an outlier. We talk in the previous podcast about not being an outlier because that's what gets the government's attention, but you were an outlier in a good way because you were really out there on the cutting edge of things. But certainly having that knowledge of what current coding and billing rules are so that you are really paying close attention to that. And then knowing your rights, if they do come knocking, the do's and don'ts. And I think really up there is just knowing that you do need an attorney as soon as possible and an attorney who knows this field. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Congratulations. I'm sure as it is in civil litigation, it doesn't feel like a complete victory when you had to go through the ordeal that felt totally unnecessary. But I am sure that everyone listening joins me in saying congratulations in clearing your name. And we really hope you get your money back.
This is why I'm talking about this. I'm not ashamed. I did everything right. I'm not ashamed. I talk about it as a badge of honor, and I'm going to continue to fight for fellow physicians in kind of just doing the right thing.
Well, thank you for your strength and courage and for continuing to do what you do.
Thank you very much.
So just a little bit of an update. As of May 2025, after Dr. Rafai's resounding victory in court and demonstrating that this was a case that should never, ever have been prosecuted, let alone brought to trial with the threat of jail time, Dr. Rafai's legal team filed a motion for sanctions against the prosecuting attorneys and a recoup of their legal fees. In the wake of that, interestingly, one of the prosecuting attorneys was fired the next day, and 2 others have quote-unquote retired since that motion was filed, leaving the motion now somewhat in limbo. The judge has asked Dr. Rafai to please consider settlement talks with the government, and we'll have to see where this goes. But in the meantime, we again congratulate Dr. Rafai on his victory and thank him for his courage and for continuing to fight for good and law-abiding doctors everywhere.